You wanted the best and you got it. The hottest band in the land, Kiss.
Greetings, everybody. Patrick here. And if any of you listened yesterday, you know that we are in the middle of Kiss Week, and we are focusing on five albums from the band's career, and in depth as we get on Rockin' the Suburbs, we're going to examine them. Jim is not here this week. This was originally planned to be his vacation week, so I'm trying to honor that as best I can. And plus, I really wanted to talk about Kiss for a week without him scowling at me furtively. So yesterday we had my friend David Bishop, the Bish, who is a drummer in the band I play in and a longtime friend. And today, another friend of mine who I'm happy to say I've gotten to know since this podcast started and actually hung out with in person. It's Scott Boykin from Louisville. Scott, how are you doing, man?
Doing well, Patrick. Yeah, thanks for having me on here to discuss Kiss.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I gotta ask something, Scott. The Bish, who I talked to yesterday, we talked about Alive. So that was kind of the album that got us into Kiss. But he is a longtime Cincinnati Reds fan. And I happen to know that you are a longtime Cincinnati Reds fan. Is there any connection here between Kiss and the Cincinnati Reds, or is this just a weird coincidence?
I would like to say it's a coincidence, but they both have long and suffering fan bases.
There you go. Maybe that's what it is. And, you know, as we talked about yesterday, Kiss, you know, kind of broke in the Midwest. And I remember we were talking yesterday about some Kiss posters that we had. And I remember on WKRP in Cincinnati, in one of the early episodes, they unrolled that Kiss poster, sure. Right? And I was like, here's our mission statement for this radio station. So that was kind of cool.
Yeah, the Kiss Army actually originated in Terre Haute, Indiana, which is just 2 hours north of where I'm at. So
is that right? Wow, that's amazing. I didn't know that.
So whatever, for whatever reason, the Midwest just, they love Kiss.
Yeah, yep. And obviously, as we'll talk about in some specific cases here today. So we're going to talk about Destroyer. This is probably my favorite studio album by Kiss, I would say. And many people, and we'll get your thoughts too, Scott, many people consider it kind of the peak of the band's career. Let me give a little background here on Destroyer so we can kind of set the context. This record came out March 15th, 1976. So it came out in our bicentennial year. And by late April, the record had already gone gold. So as we talked about yesterday, the first three Kiss studio albums did not sell very well, about 100,000, 120,000, somewhere in that range, which, you know, definitely not what the band were looking for. And then Alive became a huge hit, somewhat unexpected. And so the band's audience had really increased, and Destroyer, you know, with a lot of these new Kiss fans and others, went gold, you know, within, gosh, 2 months. So it's pretty amazing. It rose all the way to number 11 on the charts by mid-May. Then the album, you know, sort of took a little bit of a nosedive, and it did recover and come back onto the charts a little later. And we'll talk about why it did. There was a song on there that was a pretty big hit single, and unlike anything Kiss had done. So we'll talk about that. But I'm interested, Scott, tell us your Kiss origin story. When did you first get into them, and you know, how did that happen? And I do want to hear about your copy of Destroyer too. That's treasured, that you sort of hinted when we were preparing for this.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Kiss is really the gateway to where I am now. I mean, mm-hmm. They were the first band that I said, you know, this is my life right here.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, it was really a transformative experience. First time I saw and heard them. Mm-hmm. And I can remember this day like it was yesterday. But the first time I heard Kiss, or remember hearing Kiss, I should say, was on October 29th, 1976. I'm 6 years old. sitting on my couch. I've got a horrific earache, so I'm just laying on the couch. But the Paul Lynn Halloween special is coming on. And for anyone that's, you know, our age, you know, Paul Lynn was the height of comedy in 1976. So he's having a Halloween special. Kiss is the musical guest. Mm-hmm. And they end up playing, I believe it was three songs. You know, they played Detroit Rock City, King of the Nighttime World, and Beth, of course. But they're playing Detroit Rock City, and I mean, you know, the band's in makeup, they're in their costumes, you know, the stage is filled with smoke, there's fire, there's explosions, you know, everything a six-year-old boy wants in a rock band. They had it. And, you know, after that show, you know, I just talked to my parents constantly about this band I had saw.
Yeah.
On the Paul Lynn Halloween special. And then several days later, they went out and bought Destroyer for me.
Still have that copy of Destroyer, that original copy?
I still have my original copy of Destroyer that I got in November of 1976. It's you know, the corners are a little chipped up on there, but I was playing it just the other day, and for an album that's, you know, 44 years old, it still sounds pretty good on the turntable.
Yeah, I know. Mine is in a similar tore up condition. I remember spending a lot of time, I used to take tracing paper and put it over the cover of my Kiss albums and trace, you know, like the costumes. And then I would go and pretend I had drawn it myself, you know, and try to transfer it onto a regular piece of paper. It was a pursuit that I took under very seriously. But, you know, I think you said it really well, Scott. As a gateway group, they got you into rock and roll. It wasn't overly elaborate. You know, I think nowadays we go back and cringe a little bit at the lyrics, right?
Sure.
But, you know, at the time, the lyrics were what the lyrics were. And you know, the lyrics were never really that important to Kiss. It was more like the expression and the power and everything they gave. And, you know, the band was really, their popularity was really kind of exploding at this
sure.
time. And what's interesting, so you mentioned Beth. This was a single that was released a little bit later from the album, but ended up becoming a top 10 hit. You know, the thing about Beth is obviously very saturated with strings, and it's, you know, kind of a desolate kind of a song. But to me, I was so blown away. Here comes the drummer, and he comes out and sits on a stool, right, with a microphone and sings a song. Like, to me, I was like, I don't understand that can happen in a band. Like, drummers don't, you know, sing ballads. It's, you know, you're the drummer. That's what's cool. You stay back there and don't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
'cause me and the boys will be playing all night.
It is pretty amazing. And you know, it's funny looking back at it now, but I mean, Kiss has kind of modeled themselves as a cartoon version of the Beatles. You know, they've got the two leaders who, you know, and Paul and Gene, who do most of the heavy lifting. And then, you know, they'll throw a bone to Ace and Peter once or twice an album. You know, let them sing lead vocals. And, you know, it's kind of funny kind of looking back on it now.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But so many impressions it created in so many, you know, impressionable young minds. And let me give a little more context. So we talked about Beth. It was the fourth single released from the album. The first three were Shout It Out Loud, Flaming Youth, Detroit Rock City, all considered classic Kiss songs now.
Sure.
But none of those really, you know, kind of took off as a single. Rock and Roll All Night from Alive had done pretty well when it was released later as a single, but Beth took off. Now, what's really interesting here is the big change with Kiss when they went into the studio this time was they brought in a producer called Bob Ezrin. And this guy had produced Alice Cooper.
Sure.
And that's probably one of the reasons he was chosen. I mean, I don't know what you would say, Scott. I think Alice Cooper was probably pretty analogous to Kiss, right? I mean, he was more successful, I think, but he was doing something kind of similar with a very outlandish kind of a stage show, and yet he was playing that kind of stripped down rock and roll. And Ezrin really was a guy, and who later went on to produce a Jayhawks record, weirdly
yes,
enough.
A great Jayhawks record.
Right? It really is great. And I think Gary Louris might have even talked about the fact that when you were in the studio with Bob, it was his show and you were following his rules. And this is not something that had ever happened to Kiss before. But like you said, Scott, Gene and Paul were the leaders of the band and they were receptive to this because they wanted to be famous, you know, rock stars.
Sure.
They wanted to do this. So not only did, you know, he come in with, you know, ideas about how each song would be shaped, he made them do a lot of takes of songs and, you know, over and over until he got it just right. And that was not something they were used to doing either. I mean, they were used to going in on those first three albums, cutting the tracks, getting it done, getting out the door and getting back on the road. But this was a much longer production. I don't know. What are your thoughts on the production? You know, you said you listened to it not long ago, Scott. I mean, how does it sound to you today? And you know, what sticks out when you listen to the record?
You know, what's really distinctive, I mean, it jumps off the turntable as far as the sound. I mean, it is a very powerful sound, especially when you compare it to the first three studio albums, which are very, I mean, it sounds like they're probably recorded in a couple days, you know, and ready to
on
go. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But I remember hearing an interview with Bob Ezrin talking about producing Destroyer. And when he took the job, you know, he said he looked at Kiss as cartoon characters. They look the part, but they never sounded the part. So his idea was to make these guys sound as big and powerful and colorful as possible. And I think he did that. And like you said, you know, he ran the show in the studio. And from what I understand, you know, there's still some debate as to what Kiss members actually played on the album and how much they may have played on the
yeah.
album. And I know for one, I know that, you know, I've read that Ace Frehley hates Bob Ezrin with a passion.
Right.
Because I think Bob was really after Ace, you know, take after take. And like I said, there's probably some debate as to how much Ace ended up actually playing on the record.
No, exactly right. And from what you read and what you absorb through history, I mean, Ace was as laid back right as they come. And he just sort of wanted to go along for the ride and have a good time. Working this hard was not, you know,
right.
something that, you know, he did. And it's interesting when you look at the tracks, mostly there would be Paul and Gene were bringing in material. And occasionally there would be an Ace would usually have a song
sure.
on the record, right? Maybe Peter Criss would sing one, but he hadn't really, you know, stepped to the forefront too much. And here, Flaming Youth is kind of the big Ace Frehley song, but you also get Bob Ezrin's name, you know, on the writing credit. So he obviously had done pretty extensive work. And, you know, Paul Stanley ends up singing the song, too.
My parents think I'm crazy.
Just an amazing 3-minute kind of song that kicks off the second
record. It sure does, yeah.
But I think you're right. It's a great way of saying it. Like, he actually did make them have the impact on record that they had when you saw him live. And that was the whole key that they'd never unlocked that before. And they did it with a mix of ballads. I mean, if you look at the song Great Expectations, right? That's a very kind of intense song with a lot of strings on it. And when you look at these tracks, a lot of them, I mean, are just stone cold Kiss classics, right? It's really pretty seminal. What are your thoughts on kind of side one, Scott? I mean, Detroit Rock City, King of the Nighttime World, God of Thunder, and Great Expectations, which is really kind of a Gene classic.
Yeah. For me, Destroyer, those trio of opening tracks are just, they're classic Kiss. You know, like you said, with Detroit Rock City kicking it off. And from the very beginning, you know this is going to be different than any other Kiss record. Because Kiss had never recorded anything that sounded close to Detroit Rock City. Almost sounds like a completely different band than the first three studio records.
It does, yeah.
And then, you know, they launch right into King of the Nighttime World and finally, you know, God of Thunder. I saw the first farewell tour in 2000, and then I've seen the recent farewell tour in 2019. So, but yeah, I mean, they're still playing, you know, Detroit Rock City and God of Thunder to this day. And, you know, so, you know, like I said, those first three are just classics. Then you get to Great Expectations, and it is so different than the first three songs. And really different from anything they had recorded up to that point. And you realize at that time, looking back on it now, that they were dealing with a big-time producer who was determined to have these guys kind of stretch their wings a little bit and do more than just, you know, kind of pseudo Alice Cooper, you know, hard rock songs. Many things I throw to say. As a six-year-old, Great Expectations just was like, what is this? You know, you're just coming off God of Thunder, which is classic Gene Simmons. And then you go into Great Expectations and you're just like, I'm not sure this is what I signed up for.
The theme, I guess, we'll return to, because I totally have the same experience and agree with you, as this gateway band. I mean, they made you understand you could do slower music, you know, that could evoke these different emotions. And it's probably the best example. I mean, Beth was a hit song that, you know, even girls liked it, and it was like not that cool for you to like it, right? But yeah, Great Expectations, totally different. And, you know, you were talking about King of the Nighttime World. Kim Fowley was one of the main writers of that tune. So Ezrin was also bringing in outside writers, and also Kim Fowley gets co-credit on Do You Love Me, which is a song in the second half. I'm not sure exactly who it was that made the call to bring in Bob Ezrin, but, you know, it was definitely a success. And we won't get into the other Bob Ezrin production that he did later with Kiss.
That would be a whole week in itself.
Yes. The Music from the Elders, to which we refer. Now, looking at the second side of the record, I don't know, what are your thoughts, Scott, on what's in store on after you flip the Destroyer album over?
Yeah, I mean, after Great Expectations, you kind of go back into the classic Kiss mode, you know, with Sweet Pain. So you're kind of, you know, you're like, okay, now I'm kind of back in my comfort zone here and, you know, kind of getting what I expected. And up until that ballad, it's more classic Kiss coming at you, but sounding much bigger and much bolder than ever before.
Yeah.
Shout It Out Loud is just an anthem.
It is. I mean, it's, you know, it's the classic Kiss song.
Absolutely. I mean, it could almost be the Ramones if you sped it up a lot, you know, but because it's got that same kind of like shout along, you know, let's do it kind of a feeling to it.
That is one of the few times where Paul and Gene actually share vocals. If you're going to introduce somebody to Kiss, that's a perfect song to do it with. I mean, you get Paul, yeah. You get Gene, you got the huge chorus. It's rocking. I mean, you can memorize the song hearing it twice and you got it down.
Yeah.
You know, it's as simple as can be, but also makes an impact.
Yeah. Yeah. I think when we were talking about Do You Love Me, that to me is kind of like the personification of the Paul Stanley, you know, aura, right? The sort of the star man, the, you know, the lover's boy in the group and all that. I was joking, but not only did Beth, I think, you know, help them cross over. And, you know, I think I remember seeing them like on American Bandstand once doing Beth or something like that. Do You Love Me also brought a slightly different element. There definitely was sex, you know, alluded to on the earlier records, but this was kind of different. This was more of a declaration of love in a different way. And I think that, you know, also helped sort of broaden the band's appeal too.
I agree completely. And like you said, it's kind of the perfect Paul Stanley statement.
Fally gets a writing credit here, and along with Ezrin. So Ezrin gets a writing credit on pretty much every song except for two, except for Sweet Pain and God of Thunder, which by all accounts had been demoed out pretty much to a finish point when they were brought into the studio. But his hand really was deeply in there shaping everything that became Destroyer. And there's also this little, a few seconds after it ends, there's this short, like, minute and a half little thing that's tacked on there. And that was another thing that always kind of blew my mind. It's like, what in the world, you know?
It's such a strange album, the way it's framed, because, you know, you got the DJ at the beginning before Detroit Rock City, and then this little instrumental part at the end of Do You Love Me. So, I mean, it's really trying to show that they're more than just, you know, the dumb 3-minute hard rock songs that they had done up to that point. You know, trying to show a bit more ambition.
Agree. But also the songs just hold up as rock and roll songs. And I was frankly very surprised about how much I liked it when I went back to listen to it. It's been a long time since I sat there and played the whole thing straight through, but man, it really still sounds fantastic.
Yeah, I think it still holds up. I mean, if any Kiss record, I think it holds up, especially from the 70s Kiss albums.
Let's talk a minute about the cover of this album, because it's pretty classic.
Absolutely.
And it's like one of those paintings that you stood there and you studied over and over while you listened to the record.
The city or whatever it is behind them in flames. And, you know, they're standing on top of it triumphantly. I mean, it's part of the package. You know, you could not have Destroyer without that album cover. You could not pair an album cover with the music any better.
So let's talk a little bit about you personally, Scott, and Kiss. Like, how long did you stick with the band? And, you know, once you got Destroyer, did you go back and get everything else? Or kind of how did your fandom evolve?
Yeah, it was. Once I had Destroyer, you know, I had to go back and get Alive and
you know, get all the older records. And of course,
yep.
you know, really up until probably, I guess, Lick It Up, you know, I was into it, you know, but once, you know, Peter left first and then Ace is gone and the makeup comes off and, you know, as a fan, part of the mystique is gone. I will say this, I still feel obligated to see Kiss every time they're around just because they're the ones that, you know, have led to my love of music. So I feel like, you know, I need to pay homage. So whenever Kiss comes to town, I feel obligated to buy a ticket. And to be honest, every time I leave there, I leave with a smile on my face. You know, regardless of how old I am, I have a good time.
That's so cool. And I think it means a lot that you would do that for a group. you know, that kind of loyalty is important. So, again, 1976, Kiss, Destroyer. If you've never heard it, what are you doing listening to this podcast? Go listen to Destroyer. And I would say, too, in all seriousness, though, if you've never really taken Kiss very seriously, if you are not of the age where, like Scott and I, they made an impression on you, you know, when you were younger and kind of stuck with you your whole life. I mean, would you say this would be a good place to start, Scott, and go and, like, check out Destroyer?
If you're looking to see, you know, what is Kiss all about, Destroyer's the one I would point to, because really it's the blueprint for the rest of their career. You know, they started working with better producers. They started using outside writers, bringing in additional musicians to play on the records. I mean, it laid the groundwork for everything that was to come after it.
Yeah, totally. Very, very well said. And with that, Scott, I don't know if you have any additional thoughts or anything that we haven't covered about Destroyer or Kiss in general.
No, I think we've covered Destroyer pretty well. Go out there and listen to it, folks. So it still sounds great.
And so if you have thoughts on Kiss or Destroyer, or you just want Jim to come back and me and Scott to stop talking about Kiss, you can get in touch with us. We are at Suburbs Pod on all the social medias. You can email us, rock@suburbspod.com. And go to our website, suburbspod.com. All the contact info is there. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter, which is absolutely free. And that will kind of keep you up to date on all the happenings with our podcast. And hope if there's angry reaction and you get pelted with rocks and garbage for doing Kiss Week, that's where you'll find out about it, too. We'll have photos. You can also find out what's coming up on the show. And if you missed any episodes, it's a good place to go catch up there. So I wanted to say to Scott Boykin, my friend and community member, thank you so much for taking the time to jump on and talk about your love of Kiss. We really appreciate it.
I appreciate it, Patrick. Thanks for having me. It's been a blast.
Anytime. All right, folks. I am Patrick Foster, and with me has been
Scott Boykin.
Scott, thanks. We will talk to you guys about more Kiss tomorrow.